Well, today is December 8th, which means, guys, we've only got like a week or two before the Christmas shopping season begins. So write it down on your calendar, make sure. But thankfully, many of us are able to do our shopping online. The convenience of shopping online these days is really, it's simply incredible. It's especially true for buying books, and I like to buy books. And while I would like to shop locally more, so much of what is sold in bookstores is, well, not the sort of book I would buy, including Christian bookstores. But this is understandable in light of the keen insight that great Roman statesman Cicero recently tweeted. He said, "Times are bad. Children no longer obey their parents, and everyone is writing a book." It was a great tweet. It can seem that the only real qualification for getting published is having a large social media presence. And so we end up with lots of self-help books disguised as Christian books. There was a book released this year written by a certain celebrity pastor called "Do the New You: 6 Mindsets to Become Who You Were Created to Be." I have not read this book, okay, just for honesty here. But according to the Amazon listing, the second practical mindset we should have, according to this particular book, is this: Christ is in me. I am enough. Again, I haven't read it. This is from the Amazon listing. So I'm willing to look past the fact that they apparently misspelled the words "he is." I mean, at least in the second point, it's supposed to be "Christ is in me. He is enough." Now, I'm not trying to make fun of this particular author. We sing songs that he co-authored. I would agree with the saying attributed to Spurgeon, though, that if a rascal will lead me to Christ, then let him lead me to Christ. So I'm not trying to make fun of him, but I want to illustrate how often we approach the Bible with the perspective that God plus me equals anything I want to do. That so often the message that is preached and written in books is that if God will offer me just a little bit of assistance, then I can do whatever I want to do. There's nothing I cannot accomplish if God gives me some help. Well, our text this week and next in particular can be read in this way. If we were to read our text in this way, however, we will miss a significant shadow of the King who is to come. We will miss the good news, the gospel that is contained in it. Look, the gospel is not seen in how great you and I can be, but in how great God is. Not in partnership with us, but in spite of us. This isn't a put down. This isn't self-deprecation up here. This is good news. We're in Judges 6 and part of chapter 7, beginning in verse 33. "Now all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east came together, and they crossed the Jordan and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet, and the Abiezrites were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, and they too were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they went up to meet them. Then Gideon said to God, 'If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, behold, I am laying a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece alone, and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said.' And it was so. When he rose early next morning and squeezed the fleece, he wrung enough dew from the fleece to fill a bowl with water. Then Gideon said to God, 'Let not your anger burn against me. Let me speak just once more. Please, let me test just once more with the fleece. Please, let it be dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground let there be dew.' And God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground there was dew. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring of Harod. And the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, 'The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, "My own hand has saved me." Now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead. Then 22,000 of the people returned and 10,000 remained. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, shall go with you. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, shall not go with you. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouths, was 300 men, but all the rest of the people knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand, and let all the others go, every man to his home. So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets. And he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. As we've seen, God raised up Gideon to be a deliverer of Israel. But as we've seen, Gideon wasn't ready. See, God had to assure him of his calling and had to assure him God himself would give him the victory through Gideon's hand. And then God instructed Gideon to tear down his father's altar to Baal and his Asherah pole. We saw that last week. And as we saw, this endangered Gideon's life as the entire town was angry at this loss of their community worship site. But in this, in the destruction of this altar and the chopping down of this Asherah pole, God was actually rescuing Israel. See, the people thought their biggest problem was Midian, but God was rescuing them from their bigger danger, idolatry. But this act also served to strengthen Gideon. And yet, though he is now strengthened a bit, he is still not ready. His faith is still weak. He is still fearful. He is not ready to lead Israel into battle. The Midianites are not waiting for him to get ready, however. The remarkable thing is they know of Gideon. Apparently, according to the text, even though Gideon claims to be the least in his father's house, essentially a nobody, in chapter 7, later in there, we read that the Midianites not only know his name, they know what he has done. See, this worship site God had him destroy appears to have been more than just something for that particular town. This was a major attraction in the entire region. And surely the Midianites knew how various judges had from time to time been raised up to rescue Israel from others, and they would have assumed Gideon was next in line. Now, for this reason, the text says the Midianites and the Amalekites and this other group, the people of the east, they join forces together, they cross the Jordan River into the territory, into the land. They are encamped in the Valley of Jezreel. Now, if we were more familiar with the geography, we would recognize this is the place where God gave them overwhelming victory against Sisera and his army. And of course, God used rain and some mud to do so. This is the location where God, just a few years prior to this, had given them overwhelming victory over a substantial army. So perhaps these three groups coming together think that they can get the jump on Israel. Right? Let's not wait for them to get ready. Let's take the battle to them. So maybe if they take the battle to Israel, it will be much easier to defeat them. I mean, after all, Israel doesn't have a standing army. They don't have battle-hardened soldiers. They have farmers and sheep herders. Besides, we already know that they're not very powerful because for 7 years, groups just like this one would cross the Jordan at harvest time and steal all their crops. And they did nothing to stop them because they weren't powerful. These groups think that by engaging the battle earlier, when Israel might have not have been expecting it quite yet, they will get the edge over them. Apparently, they hadn't read verse 34. The Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon. Gideon is the only judge said to have been clothed by the Spirit. Now, we read that the Holy Spirit was upon Othniel, and he defeated Cushan-Rishathaim. The Spirit of the Lord is going to be on Jephthah in chapter 11, and he's going to be victorious. We'll see in chapter 13 that the Spirit of God is going to begin to stir in Samson, and then in 14 and 15, the Spirit is going to rush upon Samson, and he's going to have victory. But only Gideon is clothed with the Spirit. That is, the Holy Spirit covered him or surrounded him, overwhelmed him with his power. The Spirit came upon him so powerfully, Gideon couldn't fail. Gideon is filled with God's power to do the very thing God has called him to do. So with the Spirit empowering him, Gideon signals his own townsfolk to battle. So verse 34 says the Abiezrites, that's his clan, his entire clan, they rally to his side. Now remember, he's the least in his father's house. He's the one who destroyed a community treasure. He's the one who caused the people to want to murder him. And yet, these same people answer his call and they come to him. As we've seen, Gideon doesn't have to be great in order for God to do great things. Well, Gideon then sends messengers throughout the tribes of Manasseh and Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. By the way, if you have one of the maps we have for you out in the lobby, it might be easier on some of these to follow along. But if you look at that map, you'll notice that all of these tribes are the four northernmost tribes. The text tells us that these armies would swoop down through all the way down into the southwest to Gaza, but those four northern tribes were the most affected by these by this oppression. Now, what's remarkable is that given that Gideon's self-assessment, right, his own recognition that he is nobody special, while that's accurate, it is true he's not anyone special, the Spirit of the Lord surrounds him and enables him to lead. So men from these tribes join him there near this valley of Jezreel. Now we got to understand, Gideon knows exactly what it is that God has called him to do. There's no question in his mind the instructions the Lord has given him. God has been very clear. He is to raise an army and he is to meet the people of the east and the Amalekites and the Midianites in battle and drive them out of the land. This is simple and straightforward. It's hardly easy. I mean, it's a difficult task. The battle belongs to the Lord, however, and I want you to listen carefully. Gideon's responsibility is not to drive them out. He is not responsible and being held accountable for the outcome of the battle. Gideon's responsibility, what he's being held accountable for, is to enter into the battle in faith. The battle has always belonged to the Lord. Gideon is not responsible for the outcome. He is responsible to obey. In response to his obedience, the Lord will drive them out. Now, the fact that Gideon calls the men of his clan to him and the men of Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali shows us he knows what he's there to do. He is there to engage in battle. He's assembling an army. He knows he's not calling them to a bocce ball tournament. Okay? He knows what's happening here. The Lord has made it clear he will be victorious in the battle in which Gideon is to engage. And still, Gideon seeks assurance. In verse 36, he tells the Lord that if God will in fact save Israel through him, now notice carefully what he says, as you have said, right? He knows what God has said, well, then he needs a sign. The sign is not seeking to know what God wants him to do. He's received the promises. He knows what he's being called to do. He's already received more assurances than any other judge in the entire book. Yet he seeks further assurance. Now, his plan is he's going to place a fleece on the threshing floor. Remember what a threshing floor is. It's a flat area that's probably solid stone. It's used where you pound wheat and other grains in order to break the kernel off the stalk and separate it. Now, this floor would be kept clean for its next use throughout the year with the various harvests. Now, a fleece is simply a hunk of sheep's wool after it has been sheared. The sign he's seeking is for the fleece to be wet and the threshing floor to be dry in the morning. This is a terrible sign. This is like asking of the Lord, look, here's the sign I need. If the sun rises tomorrow, I'll know what you're telling me to do. This is obvious. You see, people living in desert areas, even today, can use this method to get water. The fleece is made up of thousands of individual strands of hair, which means a given fleece has a tremendous amount of surface area. Okay? When there's dew in the area, it collects on surfaces. And so it's not surprising. They again, still today in desert areas, they use this method to get drinking water. But by the time Gideon would check it in the morning, perhaps the wind would have dried the flat surface of the threshing floor. And of course, the fleece, having so much surface area, would still be wet. But Gideon knew this. When he checked the fleece in the morning, he saw that it was in fact still wet with dew. He could fill a bowl with the water. Duh. This isn't remarkable. Well, he recognizes the absurdity of the sign in verse 39. But he's also recognizing that he's starting to border on impertinence because by asking for another sign, he's delaying his obedience for another day. Dew happens at night. Not like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so to ask for more dew means we got to wait another cycle. So he tells God that we got to try it out once more. This time, instead of the fleece being wet, let the threshing floor be wet and the fleece absolutely dry. This would be out of the ordinary. You see the Lord's response? Verse 40, chapter 6. And God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground there was dew. God has been very clear. He is with Gideon, and he has empowered Gideon to do exactly what he calls him to do. He will give the Midianites into his hand, period. And Gideon, knowing this, asks for more evidence. Again, he's already received more assurance than any other judge, yet God relents. God relents and gives him the evidence he wants. You know, it's very interesting that nowhere is Gideon chastised for seeking a sign. In fact, as we'll see in next week's text, God realizes he needs more, and so God's going to offer him a sign. You know, in the book of Isaiah, Ahaz was king. Ahaz was facing, the kingdom had split into two at this point. The northern kingdom of Israel, had partnered with the kingdom of Syria, and they were threatening Judah. And of course, they were an overwhelming force, and so Ahaz is worried. And in Isaiah 7:10, Isaiah goes to Ahaz on behalf of the Lord and tells him, you must ask the Lord for a sign. Anything he wanted, any evidence he wanted whatsoever that would assure him that God was going to protect Judah, God would give it. And we read this in Isaiah 7. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. And he said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men, that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. See, Ahaz refused to ask for a sign, so the Lord gave him a sign anyway. Now, in that context, there's the initial fulfillment of this in that a young woman did give birth, and before the infant had grown, the Assyrian army invaded both Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel, ending their threats against Judah. So when we read this, God is not angry with Gideon for seeking further assurance. God gives him the assurance he needs. Having this assurance, verified by the sign, Gideon gets up the next day ready for battle. You see, the right response to what God says and what God does is always obedience. Immediate obedience. Then in verse 2 of chapter 7, the Lord speaks to Gideon again. He says something remarkable. Let's look at this again. The Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Look, God has repeatedly assured Gideon he will give him the victory. He has demonstrated this in multiple ways, but then God says, yeah, your army is too big for me to give them the victory. He doesn't say Midian's army is too big. Israel's army is too big. This is actually the same warning God gave that first generation back in the wilderness, the generation that would enter into the land and take it. Back in Deuteronomy 8, when they were assembled in the wilderness, preparing to enter the land, God gave them the same warning. Now remember, in Deuteronomy 7, God had made it very clear he had not rescued them from Egypt because they were so great. He had not led them to Mount Sinai to receive a covenant because they were so great. He had not chosen them out of all the nations on the earth because they were so great. He was not planning to lead them into the land of Canaan and give them victory over the Canaanites because they were so great. In fact, he says he did those things and would do those things entirely because he loved them. In other words, it was because of how great he is that he would do it. He would do them because he had made a promise to Abraham. Then in chapter 8, God tells those same people that the time is coming when he is going to give them the land and he's going to grant them incredible prosperity. They would have plenty of food, plenty of natural resources like copper to mine, that sources that would enrich them. They would be wealthy beyond imagination. But look at God's warning. God says to them, take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes, which I command you today, lest When you have eaten and are full and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through the great and terrifying wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers as it is to this day. So notice the danger. God will fulfill his promises. And Israel will be blessed beyond imagination. When this happens, Israel may think it was their hand, their power that had brought these things about. If Israel experiences the fullness of God's blessing, and here's the key, and if Israel forgets that it was the Lord who rescued them, then in their arrogance, they would rebel and turn away from him. See, this combination of blessing and forgetting, the source of the blessing, is a deadly, deadly enemy. So God tells Gideon his army is too big for God to act on their behalf because he knows what would happen in this particular situation. See, they will assume they were so great that they themselves had stood up to Midian and won. So it is for their good and it is for their blessing that God refuses to rescue them with such a large army. He doesn't refuse to rescue them, however. They just need a smaller army. So to reduce the army, God instructs Gideon to send back any men who were fearful. 22,000 of them return to their tents, some distance away from where the battle will take place. The fear that God means here is not the sort of fear, the apprehension that you would naturally have before a battle when you engage in dangerous activities. The fear God means is not that. It's the same fear that Gideon had when God first appeared to him and he sort of dismissed God's promises, saying, "Oh, look, the God of Israel has forsaken his people. That's why we've struggled for 7 years." And so Israel is left with an army of 10,000. This smaller army is vastly outnumbered. The 32,000 were outnumbered, but this smaller army of 10,000 is also, it's even more outnumbered. In fact, in verse 12 of chapter 7, the text says, Gideon saw the Midianites, quote, like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore. I mean, what is 10,000 against so many? Well, it turns out that 10,000 against so many is still too many. See, God knows what will happen if he gives the victory to 10,000. So he instructs Gideon to take them down to the water's edge. Now, a large army like this, no doubt, is thirsty, and so you need some water. And so he takes them down there, and God's going to tell him which men can remain. Now, I've got to say, the text is somewhat obscure, and I got really lost in the weeds this week on this. But there's a lot of debate about what's actually happening, who's kneeling, who's cupping, who's lapping like dogs. It appears in the Hebrew that those who knelt are the same group as those who lapped, though the ESV translation seems to suggest otherwise. In fact, Old Testament scholar Daniel Block argues that the Hebrew of the text indicates the second group is merely a clarification of the first group, right? Likewise, everyone who kneels to have to drink are those who lapped water like dogs. So the idea that everyone who laps water with his tongue as a dog who laps are the same people who kneel down to drink. That is, they get down on all fours and use their hands to cup water right at the water's edge with their face in the water. These men came to battle. They came prepared. They would have had all kinds of equipment necessary to eat and survive in between the actual fighting. Like things like, you know, cups. There are many attempts out there to suggest these men were more alert, that these 300 were somehow better prepared for the battle, but this would actually go against the thrust of the text. I mean, these men were not on the lookout for danger. Their faces were near the water. The point isn't that God is searching for the best and brightest. That's not the point here at all. The point is that God doesn't need the best and the brightest in order to rescue them. Rather than looking for elite soldiers, God is actually looking for weak soldiers, right? In a very delightful mix of metaphors, Daniel Stulak summarized this point. He said, "The reader should certainly not attempt to superimpose a military rationale on the second criterion for participation. The dog lappers are not more alert than their peers and therefore constitute a band of Navy SEALs ready to do battle at Thermopylae. The Battle of Thermopylae was made famous, or maybe infamous, in the movie 300. I'm not recommending you watch it. In which 300 soldiers, though it was probably closer to 1,000 in reality, held off a much larger Persian army for 3 days. These 300 who lapped water on all fours were not shining examples of Spartan warriors hardened and chiseled ready for battle. That's not what the text is indicating. Rather than bend to scoop water up like a normal human being would do, or scoop it up in a cup to drink it, they get down on all fours like dogs. Look, if you were one of the 9,700 who drank water like a human, you would have looked a bit sideways at those people. Like, why is he drinking like that? Like, that's not normal. I mean, imagine standing in a line at a drinking fountain. You see the guy in front of you put his mouth over the spigot. Like, not how that works. That's these 300. Okay, that's who we're talking about here. Who does that, right? These aren't 300 men like Leonidas protecting his home from invaders. These are 300 men who don't know how to drink properly. See, God is whittling down Israel's army by a factor of 100. From 32,000 to just 300. And 300 men whose only significant trait, marking them out as drinking, is drinking from the water like dogs. We get the picture? Who we're talking about here? I mean, Gideon asked God for a sign that he will save Israel by his hand, as God had said he would do, and here God is giving Gideon an even greater sign. I mean, to demonstrate just how true it is that the victory belongs to the Lord chooses to go to battle with these guys. Okay? I mean, in gym class, these guys were picked last. Whether it's for dodgeball or basketball or tug of war. When the 9,700 began to separate from the 300, none of them looked at the 300 who remained to fight. Like, oh yeah, that's good. Those guys, yeah. This battle's over. No, it would have been more like, oh, yeah, we need a miracle. Here's some good news. God doesn't need superstars. I've been saying this for the last few weeks, and I'll probably keep saying it throughout this book. Gideon and the 300 do not need to be great in order for God to do great things. They don't have to be the best and the brightest. They don't have to be super warriors. They don't have to be superstars. They just have to trust the Lord. If they will trust the Lord, they can remain very ordinary and be victorious, not because they are somehow enough, but because God is enough. See, God is preparing to send Gideon into battle with 300 very, I'm not even sure I can call them ordinary men, but ordinary men, again, men whose sole qualifying characteristic is they drink water from a river like a dog, okay? Now, there are other times where God sent a much larger army. In his wisdom, he understands this time they need to see for themselves their inability to rescue themselves. Look, sometimes God may choose to send substantial force to rescue his people, as he did with Othniel, the first judge. Sometimes he may choose to use mud in order to render iron chariots useless, as he did with Barak. Sometimes he may choose to use human cunning, as he did with Ehud. And sometimes he may choose to use 300 dog lappers. But in every case, the battle belongs to the Lord. The victory is victorious because God fights for Israel. In none of these cases is the judge himself to be given credit for the outcome. Listen, the reality is that all of Israel are the 300. See, the 300 are a subset of the whole, but the 300 truly represent the whole. That was God's point in Deuteronomy 7. He didn't choose them because they were so great. He didn't choose them because they were so powerful. He didn't choose them because they were so numerous. If that had been the reason, he would have chosen the Egyptians to be his people. They were the most powerful nation on earth. They were the most advanced technologically on earth at the time. God didn't choose them. He chose Israel. The 300. This is the pattern, isn't it? I mean, think of the men the Lord chose to be his disciples. The 12 men who would walk closest to him, the very men through whom he would change the world. Think of these men. In Mark 9, Jesus tells them he's going to be killed rather soon, right? He's going to be physically assaulted. He's going to be beaten. He's going to be spit upon. He's going to have his beard ripped out. And then they're going to nail him to a cross. You remember their response? So yeah, when you're king, which one of us gets to be your right-hand man? What is wrong with you people? Are you kidding me? He just told you he's going to die. He's going to be killed, nailed to a cross. And you want to be the greatest in his kingdom? Well, after telling them repeatedly that he was going to be arrested and beaten, that he would suffer and be crucified, in John 13, he's having this meal with them one night. He says one of them, one of the 12, one of his shining examples of humanity, is going to betray him, setting into motion his arrest and suffering and death. He tells them they will soon look for him, but they won't be able to find him. And so Peter asks, where are you going? To the grave, dummy! He just told you that! Jesus simply says that where he is going, they cannot follow. And so Peter, being Peter, says he will follow Jesus anywhere, including to the grave. Jesus simply tells him he will not actually follow him to the grave. In fact, before morning, he's going to deny Jesus 3 times. He then tells them all that he's going to prepare a place for them. And Thomas, with all his insight, says, we don't know where that is, and we don't know the way there. This is after 3 years. Jesus tells them then in John 14 that he is the way to the Father. He said to know him is to know the Father. To see him is to see the Father in action. And then Philip, one of the first to recognize Jesus, said, well, just show us the Father then, and then we'll know. What is wrong with you people? This is after 3 years with Jesus. For 3 years, he had taught them and walked with them, and still they had no clue. They had no idea who Jesus really is. They were just a group of men on all fours, lapping water from the river of life like a dog. Most of them were ordinary men. Matthew was a tax collector, as you know, which means he would have had some formal education, but it also meant he was a betrayer of his own people because the tax collectors brought oppression on behalf of the Roman Empire. We know that Peter would run his mouth for hours before his brain caught up to what he was saying. James and John were so hot-headed, they wanted to call down God's wrath on everyone they didn't like. They were clueless. These men whom Jesus called to change the world. But then something happened. The day of Pentecost. You see, as with Gideon, the Holy Spirit came upon these country bumpkins, these men who had funny accents because they were from the north, you know, near Nazareth. And you know what they say, can anything good come from Nazareth? In their case, however, the Spirit would not depart after the task was finished. Instead, the Spirit would dwell among his people as a permanent indwelling because the presence and activity of God's Spirit is the sign of the new covenant. Now, sometime not long after Pentecost, Peter and John are boldly preaching Christ in the temple. The rulers had them arrested because this was creating a disturbance. And then we read these words. Now, when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived they were uneducated, common men, they were astonished. And they recognized that they had been with Jesus. See, the rulers recognized these disciples were uneducated common men. They were dog lappers, right? They were the 300. There was nothing special about them. They didn't have large vocabularies. They weren't reading the latest scientific literature. They didn't have graduate and postgraduate degrees. However, they had this one characteristic that set them apart. They had been with Jesus. Because they had been with Jesus, they had begun to become like Jesus. You see, in this whittling down of Gideon's army, we see a shadow of Jesus, a shadow of the king who is to come, a hint of his divine rescue. You see, Jesus came and he was much like Gideon, or rather, Gideon gave us a glimpse into what Jesus would be like, right? His own brothers, for example, thought he was crazy. Before Pentecost, his own brothers thought Jesus was crazy. He was the least in his father's household, though in this case, it's just his earthly father. And he was from Nazareth. That alone made Jesus a nobody. But Paul tells us that even though Jesus is God in every way, and therefore worthy and deserving of all honor and glory and praise and worship, Jesus didn't grasp at what was his by right. He didn't insist that his glory be recognized. Instead, he says he made himself a servant. He made himself a nobody. He didn't even own a house. Being a servant, Jesus found himself falsely accused and beaten, falsely convicted, and he was killed as a common criminal. In fact, as an enemy of the state on a cross outside Jerusalem. And then he was buried, but not in his own tomb. He couldn't even afford that. He was buried in a borrowed tomb. We know how it ended. On the third day, he walked out of his tomb in victory. You see, he had defeated sin and death. Through his own suffering and death, through his own weakness, God had delivered his people from the greatest enemy they faced. That's because God's power is displayed through weakness. This is why Gideon didn't have to be great in order for God to do great things. In fact, not only did Gideon not have to be great, it was necessary for him to not be great. So I have good news, New City. We're not great. We're not a huge church. We don't have a massive budget. We don't have a lot of highly influential people. If New City were a book, we wouldn't be a bestseller. We're not full of people reaching their maximum potential. We aren't flashy. We're not trying to be. We don't try to draw attention to ourselves. But the truth is, we are a bit odd. We are the 300. I mean, who confesses sin publicly, regularly? Who does that? What church does that? Who routinely acknowledges their desperate need for Jesus in the midst of the struggle, be it with depression or temptation or pain? What kind of church sees discipleship not as a set of fancy programs that are well organized, but in messy relationships? We are the 300. And there's no place I would rather be. You see, from the perspective of best-selling authors, we don't have a lot to offer. We do, however, have the Lord in our midst. Because of who he is, because of what he has done, you and I do not have to strive to be influencers. We don't have to strive to have a perfect persona, whether online or in person. We're not trying to make anyone impressed with us. We can be the 300. Because through faith in Jesus, God can be great and God can do great things. In fact, here's the mindset we must adopt. Christ is in us. He is enough. We just need to be more like him.